Okay, welcome to this meeting organised by the Socialist Party. Well, today we have a long-standing friend of the Socialist Party. I think you've known the party. Yehudi's known the party since the 1980s, and he's been living and teaching in America. So he's over here for a few weeks. So we thought we'd catch him, ask him to do a talk for us. And I think the title has been changed various times. And it's now Ideological Obstacles to Societal Transformation, which is ideological objections to changing society towards socialism. Okay, without more ado, I'll hand over to Yehudi to give his talk. How long will it be going on for?
5 hours or so.
Okay. Sorry, I meant Fidel Castro. Right, okay, over to you then.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, thank you for being here. I will say, the less the merrier. It's less embarrassing when you make mistakes in front of, say, 10 people rather than 10,000 people. So thank you for being here anyway. I'm going to start with the statement by John Maynard Keynes over there. I hope your eyesight is better than mine and you can read that. Where he says something to the effect that actually ideas are more powerful than most of us realize, that the world is ruled by little else. And it sounds idealistic, and for those who embrace something called materialism, it's unacceptable to say that. But I think there's some truth in that, that basically we are very much moved by our thinking. I don't think that anyone would want to deny that. In fact, one neuroscientist said that that beliefs are principles of action, that when we act, we're actually actualizing ideas in our heads. And there's a diagram there which I hope we'll get to eventually, which I use to illustrate that, the power of ideas. And in fact, that's what the SPGB is doing. We're trying to change the world to effectuate behavior modification by changing the way people think about themselves and the way they think about the world, especially this thing called capitalism. So we are engaged in processes of changing ideas, of ideational transformations, in order to change the practical reality, if I can use that ugly word, reality. So there's John Maynard Keynes. I think he's important, and can we move on there to what I call the three or four or five Greek gifts. I call them Greek gifts, but basically they're human gifts. And can you go to the next one, I think, was about reasoning. And this is a central point, I think, that comes from the ancient Greek philosophers, the classical philosophers in ancient Greece, 3rd or 4th century BCE, of course, that says that reasoning is a reasoning process underlying all human, conscious human actions. And that's the process in the center, and there are things that we do there. And their argument was that there's a reasoning process underlying those actions or those behaviors. Unfortunately, quite a few philosophers and theologians, it seems to me, misunderstood and misrepresented that Greek legacy. But I repeat, I'm saying Greek, but it's a mistake to call it Greek. It was a human gift. These are human beings who made some discoveries. I think calling them Greek is a mistake. And when people ask me, for example, where are you from, I always feel a certain amount of guilt because I want to say I am from Earth or I am from the universe. And I've done that, much to people's annoyance, or I'm from my mother's womb, and so on and so forth, because I want a discussion precisely about identity, how we call ourselves, because I think how we name ourselves affects our behavior, affects the creation of others. And I really want to say that ultimately, if we are really interested in transforming capitalist society, then we are interested in transforming the way people think about themselves. And it seems to me that ultimately we want to have them think about themselves as human beings. That's not good enough. We want to make them think about themselves as earthlings. That's still not good enough. Because it could mean that if people from Mars were to appear here, we may decide to nuke them. So I want us to think of ourselves as conscious users of theories, or wanderings of the universe. People who wonder all the time, who wonder and wonder about the universe. I think that would be all-inclusive. It would include those Martians and people from beasts and so on and so forth who might come here one day to save us. and we will not greet them with hostility because we'll see them as sisters and brothers. We're all wanderlings and wanderlings of the universe. I think that's where we ought to go. And I think it's important to do that because ultimately I think identities matter tremendously. And one of the obstacles you face and I face as we try to transform human behavior is that identities get in the way. You talk to people and you talk about what's happening in Syria or the Ukraine or some part of the world where babies are dying from hunger, and they say, I hear you, but you know, I'm not really connected to that because I'm British, I'm English, I'm Irish, I'm a woman, I'm a man, I'm black, and I'm white. To my mind, those identities are obstacles to changing, to the kind of changes we want. Because I think we want changes that affect, that are in the interest of every single being on Earth, and not just on Earth. We don't want to exclude snakes and pigs or dolphins. We want to be careful and to take care of our environment and every living being, every living entity in the environment. So I think ultimately we have to talk a lot more about identities if we're going to change the world, so to speak. More importantly, so reasoning, the Greek legacy. That's one of the legacies, or the human legacy, a focus on reasoning. And the other thing, I think I'm talking about it here, the other legacy is, of course, there's an ugly word called humanocentric. They focus on human beings. There's no way you can read the ancient or the classical philosophers and not notice that they keep talking about human beings, even though there are contradictions there and inconsistencies. They call themselves Greeks. And if you weren't a Greek, you're a barbarian. If you didn't speak perfect Greek, or if you didn't speak the Greek language, then you were an other. So we see some inconsistencies there in ancient classical philosophy. But there's a humanocentric element. There's that focus on reasoning, and there's that element of humanocentrism. Can we go on quickly, please? We'll discuss that sooner or later. To my mind, it's about power. I want to say that intellectuals and theoreticians and academics are much more powerful than people realize. I'm going back to Keynes here. That we are in there, or rather you are, I'm not, no, just kidding. We are all in there, and we imbibe ideas from the people called educators. They're very powerful. They produce our ideas, and they influence people in here that we think are powerful, the corporations, trade unions, Congress, parliaments, and so on and so forth, and they carry out decisions that affect people, the masses down there, if you like. But these people are very powerful. As you can see, there's plenty of people in media, and this is why I think that maybe the SPGB can focus more on what's going on in our educational institutions and try to attract academics like me, who are armchair intellectuals and not really concerned with what's happening out there. In fact, there's no out there. There's no out there and in here. We should regard them as potential supporters and fellow travelers and accuse them of betraying the very idea of education. Because I think, as Nietzsche or someone else pointed out, if you're not talking about social change, if you're not talking about ameliorating the human condition, then you're not doing philosophy or social sciences. And I get the impression that most academics are not doing that. Some would say they've sold out. And indeed, Marx suggested a long time ago, I think in his Night Thesis on Feuerbach, that philosophers have only interpreted the world, the problem is to change it. Now, we don't have to go along with that, because I think philosophers do more than interpret the world. And indeed, you have to interpret the world in order to change it anyway. He said something else that I think we should look at suspiciously, which is that men must first eat before they philosophize. And I think that may be true, but we often have to philosophize about what we're eating before we eat it. We've got to make decisions as to whether something is edible or not before we begin to munch. So ideas are very important. Interpretations, perceptions are critical if we are going to behave rationally and if we're going to change our social conditions. Okay, that was an aside on education. I'll get back to this, my basic subject in the end, about what's wrong, what are the obstacles to changing the world or to societal transformation. That's the title of my talk. But I thought we'd discuss some epistemological issues before we get there. Can we go to the next one? That, I think, is another, I call it education's mission here or whatever. But I'm saying this is the so-called Greek discovery, this notion that human beings are essentially, they have a disposition and ability to reason, a habit of reasoning and an urge to evaluate their reasoning. That's something that Aristotle kept emphasizing. It's very different. That conception of human beings is very different from the Judeo-Christian, or what you can call the Abrahamic conception of human beings, as beings that have a flawed nature. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's important that we embrace philosophy, especially classical Greek philosophy. This is their notion of human nature. They are looking at what human beings do. They're not saying that there's an essence. They're saying this is what human beings do. They have this urge. I call it, I memorize the acronym. They have a disposition to reason, a habit of reasoning, an ability to reason rather, the A habit of reasoning, make a habit out of it, and an urge to evaluate their reasoning. And that's crucial. That is something maybe other species do not do as often or as well as you or we do. Evaluating our reasoning and correcting our reasoning, and hence correcting our behavior and making progress, so to speak. One can argue that other species are not neurologically inclined or capable of evaluating their reasoning processes and thereby changing their behavior. So maybe this is the golden mean right here. This is the gold standard, if you like, among the species, this ability or those sets of abilities. That, as I said, is another Greek, but another human legacy. Move on, please, quickly. This is, I think, again, coming from the Greeks, this human behavior. The argument here would be that there's reasoning, and of course, first of all, there's thinking. We all agree we are thinking beings, Homo sapiens. And that's simply to say that we cognitively process sensory data coming through our senses from the so-called external world. We process that thinking. But then we also reason, which is different from thinking. Reasoning is when we draw inferences. We draw conclusions about the data that we process. For example, there's Aristotle's classical syllogism, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. That's a reasoning process. But it doesn't mean that we reason logically. And I think it's a very important thing to know and to understand, because it means that when you have discussions with people who oppose your political suggestions, they say, no, we can't change the world, people are irrational. And you say, yes, of course. People do irrational things. People don't necessarily reason logically, but they can. And that's what we are to encourage. People don't necessarily reason logically, but they can reason logically. And so we should be working our reasoning to make sure it's logical. That's logical reasoning, which is simply reasoning, within a set of principles or criteria or standards that can improve it. So, for example, I often give my students this test. And some of the results have been rather frightening. I would say, okay, I'm going to utter two sentences. All men are mortal, Socrates is a man. Tell me what comes to your mind. Now, I'm sure I just said that, right? All men are mortal, Socrates is a man. And I'm sure each of you here immediately thought, therefore Socrates is mortal. I hope you did. You'd be surprised how many people in classrooms throughout the world, how many young people will not say that, because their reasoning skills are not being cultivated, because they're not growing up in environments that actually facilitate or oblige them to reason logically, to recognize implications, to perceive inferences, to know that the moment you hear all men are mortal and Socrates is a man, instantaneously you should say Socrates is mortal. It should happen. And it doesn't in many, many cases. In many cases, I've got 50 students, and I utter the first two premises, and they say everything else except Socrates is mortal. It's a sad commentary on what happens in the lower levels of education. We're not cultivating people's ability to reason logically. And it creates difficulties for all of us, because when we approach people and say, we can create a moneyless economy without violence, and we can eradicate inequalities, and we can stop producing commodities and produce goods. We can have an abundance of commodities, or rather of goods, to gratify human needs. We can change the purpose of production. You're presenting arguments that you can logically substantiate. But insofar as they do not grow up in an environment that encourages them to think logically and examine their reasoning and reflect on their thinking, your arguments fall on deaf ears. I don't want to see you throwing pearls to swine. That's insulting. But certainly, what you're saying will not resonate, because unfortunately, because of what happens throughout kindergarten all the way to universities, they haven't got Darhu. Their Darhu has been stymied. That is, their disposition and ability to reason, the habit of reasoning, and the urge to evaluate reasoning, unfortunately, those characteristics have been stymied or repressed. So, one last point about this. One of the reasons we think differently, we argue differently, or we reason differently, is not just because, well, older people, or rather, children reason differently from adults. But the brains are smaller, less convolutions, and so on. We know that. So that's one difference. Secondly, some people are more trained in reasoning than others. Philosophers more trained in reasoning than most of us here, or if not all of us. But, above all, information. All reasoning is contextualized by information. The more informed you are, the better you reason. And this is why teachers should really seek to cultivate not just people's ability to reason, but their desire to learn. That's something else that Aristotle says in his Metaphysics. The first sentence he says there is that, look, we are, above all, human beings are learning beings. They have this unquenchable thirst for knowledge, and also they live by their reasonings. Unfortunately, philosophy is sadly neglected throughout educational institutions in the entire world, and it's becoming more and more so. Most of the universities today are looking more and more like business schools. Philosophy departments are minuscule, tiny, and the social sciences have moved away from their roots, philosophy, and I'd like to give an example of that. Can we move ahead? I'd like to show you what social sciences do. I'll get back to that in a minute.
Doesn't seem to be.
It's not there. In that case, what I was going to say is that I just made the case that the social sciences deviate from philosophy. They deviate from this focus on reasoning and this prescriptive focus that we get from the classical philosophers and from the human-centric perspective from classical philosophers. Social sciences deviate from that. They've abandoned it completely, I think. I would say completely. I think that's one of the reasons why the world is awry. Our social scientists advocate, they suggest to thousands, if not billions of students, that resources are scarce, that there isn't enough to go around, that nature is niggardly, so to speak. You can't have a world, you can't have an economic system where goods and not commodities are produced. You can't have a system of governance in which you don't have state apparatuses imposing violence on people because human nature is basically flawed. You can find that in almost every sociology textbook. That conflict is ineradicable. That conflicts among human beings cannot ever be stymied or stopped. In fact, there's a quote from Margaret Thatcher, I think sometime in the 1980s, she said in Tokyo, "You cannot eradicate violence from human society. It all goes back to Cain and Abel." I actually memorized that. She actually said that in Tokyo sometime. And I understand. I think she went to Oxford, and that's what they teach there. So I can understand that. In fact, let's look at the so-called science of economics. The classic definition of economics from Lord Robbins was that economics is a science of human behavior, which is a science of human behavior, which is action based on a recognition of scarce resources which have alternative usages. There it is. And that's the classic definition of economics. And that's what economists talk about. How can we allocate resources that are essentially and ineradicably scarce among human beings who have insatiable desires and wants? And when, therefore, when you or we tell people that we can have an economic system that can produce goods to gratify the requirements of life among human beings, they will say, no, people are not like that. It's impossible. People will want to go to the moon. Everyone will want a Lexus and a Maserati. You can't do it. They'll tell you that, of course. And then you have to tell them. Jean-Paul Sartre said the same thing. This was one of his objections to communism. He said, can't work because human desires are boundless, infinite. And you can never have an economic system that can gratify them. And so don't even think about it, for example. So, look, you've got a lot of work ahead. You've got to persuade thousands, if not millions of academics, that they've got to return to the fold, that they've got to stop, to my mind, regurgitating certain ancient ideas from what I call the Judeo-Christian world. In fact, I have this acronym which I didn't bring with me here called GRAIL, and I think the world is ruled by GRAIL, the Holy GRAIL. And in a way, it is holy, but it's not. GRAIL is an acronym meaning Greco-Roman and Abrahamic intellectual legacies. And I can delineate them, there are 12 or 13 of them, which I think I've memorized. But essentially, they are there in our heads. They are about things like scarce resources. Resources are scarce. That there are essential differences among human beings. We're not one species seeking to gratify our desires for the requirements of life. No, we are divided up. We are different kinds of human beings. That's a powerful thesis from the Greco-Roman and Abrahamic intellectual traditions. That violence is necessary and natural, unavoidable, therapeutic, essential. Yeah. It's not just in the Bible. It's in almost every textbook in sociology and in political science, and Henry Kissinger believes it. George Bush certainly, Tony Blair absolutely, and David Cameron necessarily. And this is one of the reasons why we have these incessant wars. People, human beings, have been devaluing and denigrating their nature, so to speak, for millennia. And because we act out our identities, we act upon the way we name ourselves, then the moment human beings do that, they doom themselves. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If I call myself a pacifist and Adam were to punch me in the face, then I'd be restrained. I wouldn't want to punch him back because that identity as a pacifist affects what I do. But if I think I'm aggressive naturally, that I'm a human being, but I have these animal urges within me and so on and so forth, and he would even say something untoward towards me, about me, I'd want to punch him. So ideas matter. What we tell ourselves is very, very important for what we do. And so we here have to send different messages to people if we are to get the kind of world we're talking about. The kind of world in which you don't have violence, in which you don't have hunger, starvation, malnutrition, material anxiety, a kind of world in which we don't have people looking at each other and instead of seeing their humanness, seeing themselves as being different kinds of human beings. If we're going to do that, we have to carry different messages to people. Next, please. That was Keynes, more or less.
That's the beginning. What do you want to
That's the beginning. There's one I didn't do. That one. Because as you carry your messages to people, you'll notice something else. Because of the denigration of human nature, and by implication of human reasoning, because of and I think we can discuss when it was done and how it was done, but I think it was done at least 2,000 years ago with the ascension of Christianity in the Roman Empire and then its dissemination and universalization. Human beings do not trust that through which they define themselves, their reasoning. They don't trust their own reasoning. The fact that they've denigrated, they've dissented it. They don't actually. It has an honorary presence only in our discourse, so that very often people will say to you, "Oh, you're too logical," or "You're reasoning too much." It's not a matter of reasoning, and so on and so forth. So, where am I going with this? As we talk to people, there are five possible responses that take place during conversations. Not necessarily possible. Five responses that do emerge during conversations. If I say, for example, whatever I say, and I'm really talking of responses, not the first statements. If I were to say that all women are done, if I were to say, which I've said a few times to my fifth wife, just kidding. But if I say all women are done, and someone says, "I agree with you," which is what she would say, then she has affirmed my statement. That's the first response, right? That's an affirmation. Are we there? An affirmation. That's merely accepting the validity of my observation. Yes, that's an affirmation. But then, she can also say, I think that's a denunciation. You're such a sexist. And that is to offer a negative, a pejorative description or evaluation of someone's statement. So if I say, all blacks are violent, and you say, you're racist, then you're denouncing me. You're making a moral or political evaluation of me or of the statement. If you say my statement is racist, that's a pejorative evaluation or description of the statement. If you say you're racist, that's an evaluation of me. It's also called an ad hominem, where you're addressing the arguer and not the argument. In fact, one of my frequently voiced suggestions to people is, look, argue with the argument, not with the arguer. It's shocking the extent to which people argue, especially our political leaders, throughout the entire world. I've been collecting them. From Erdogan to Obama to Cameron to Putin, the ad hominem rules the roost. They respond to each other. They attack each other rather than evaluating what is being said. We're going to kill ourselves that way. Absolutely. People are not addressing issues, they're addressing one another. And naming one another pejoratively as if that settles the dispute. So if I say all white people are racist, or all women are dumb, you should not say I'm sexist. You should say, Yehudi, define dumb. Yehudi, how did you reach that conclusion? What are your premises? Where are your assumptions? Did you do a survey? There's 1,400,000,000 people in China. Did you go over there and check out the women over there? How do you know that? By what reasoning process did you reach the conclusion that all women are dumb? That's what politicians should be doing. That's what Socrates recommended. But that tradition is lost. I think that's why we're in trouble. We are not engaged in any deep intellectual reflection. We're not examining our minds. We're not smelling our breath intellectually. And so we are going to commit omnicide. We're going to destroy. I'm almost convinced now, becoming very pessimistic, that ultimately we are on the path of self-destruction. So, when we talk, we should do A or R, this R, refute. That is what Socrates recommended. We should challenge the classifications in people's statements, as I just said. We should ask the person, how did you reach that conclusion? We should ask for evidence, examine assumptions, and so on and so forth. We should not do DRR. We should not denounce, reject, or repudiate. What's rejection? If I were to say, all English people are stupid, which I've often said, then no one should say, I don't agree with you. So what that you don't agree with me? That's irrelevant. What's wrong with what I've said? You don't agree with me? Who the hell are you? See what I mean? I don't agree? You don't. So what? You don't agree? Why don't you agree with me? Who are you? And so the discussion trails off. The statement disappears. So, to some extent, when you say something and someone responds to what you've said with a you, be very careful, be very wary. Say, wait a minute, keep me out of this. You and I are not having a fight. This is a conflict between certain ideas. That's all that's happening here. You and I are in unison. We are joined here to examine certain ideas and to check on their validity. That's hug. There's no conflict between the two of us. I think until we get that kind of approach to conversations, we're not going to get rid of violence. It seems to me. Okay. Repudiation, that's very simple. If you were to say that all black people are violent, and if for some strange reason I were to call myself black, which doesn't happen at all, and I say to you after you say that, that's not true, I'm black and I'm not violent, then if that were to happen, essentially I would be repudiating what you've said. I'm rejecting what you say on the basis of my personal experience or my personal evaluation. So repeat. Repudiation really is a step up from rejection. I'm not just saying I don't agree with you, I'm saying I don't agree with you, and I'm offering myself as evidence of the invalidity of what you've said. I don't agree with you that all blacks are stupid or violent because I'm black and I'm not. And that's not acceptable. Because you can say to me, how do you know you're black? What do you mean you say you're black? See, and we get into this again, this internet regress. So that's enough. Let's get to our subject now. Those are only preliminary remarks, but as we agree, we have 5 hours here. So that's just the initiation. We can get, I'm getting a cold. We can get into the other issues in a minute. We can get rid of all of that. Can we get the other one, which is actually this? It's not a file entirely.
Is it?
Well, yes, not a file. It's there somewhere. It's my talk. That's just, I often reach the conclusion that I should do that. I should do these so-called epistemological issues before I do any actual talk about any subject under the sun. It's called clearing the air. So if I say something that someone doesn't like, they can't say, oh, you're just an armchair intellectual, or you're philosophizing, and so on and so forth. So that's one of the reasons why. Okay, can you find it? What does it begin with? Is my title?
The title.
Yes, that's it. Yeah. Oh, good. That's it. Begins with the title. That's where it should begin. Thank you very much. Yes. Okay, we go to the beginning, actually. And it has synopsis there?
Yeah, that's all we... Yeah.
It has the word synopsis, I don't see it. It
doesn't say that.
But then maybe it's the wrong one. It must be the wrong one.
Okay.
It should have the title synopsis okay. in the title. So we are interested in social transformation, or societal. We want to change capitalism or transcend it or eradicate it. And I'm wondering, why hasn't it happened? What's stopping us, so to speak? Or what's stopping human beings from disbanding with, dispensing with, getting rid of a system that I think each of us here is convinced is somehow inhuman, inhumane, and so on and so forth.
Is that right?
Yeah, that is the one. Excellent, that's the one, yeah. Yeah, that is, I'm sure that's the one. That's the worst synopsis, is there?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the one. I never read speeches, so to speak. I'm not happy with that. But I write them out, and I just keep looking. And so there, I think if you are going to try and introduce socialism, SPGB, Change Capitalism, the Socialist Party of Great Britain, then you are suggesting that something is wrong with capitalism. And so I'd like to challenge you and ask you, what's wrong with it? And I'm sure you've been challenged. And I'm sure people, and those who believe nothing is wrong with it, will not follow you, so to speak. Will not join your organization. They'll leave you alone because you haven't demonstrated something is wrong with capitalism. Why should I change it if nothing is wrong with it? And that's a good question. So what's wrong with it? And in fact, later, I will... I mean, if you go down to A, the next paragraph, you'll see there, nothing is wrong with capitalism. So I'm going to defend it. Someone once said that the more passionately you believe in something, the more passionately you should examine the arguments against it, against your belief, precisely, right? So if you really believe that something is wrong with capitalism, then you should be able to examine the arguments against your belief. Because I can argue that nothing is wrong with it. That the inequalities about which you complain are natural to human society. After all, we're not born equal, as Margaret Thatcher suggested. Some people are tall and some are short and so on. Some people are clever, others are not. So why are you suggesting that something is wrong with inequality, for example? The inequalities we see in capitalist society are a reflection of the natural inequalities among human beings. What would you say to that? You can tell me later, right? So, but the point here is, I'm trying to say, is that you ought to know what's wrong with the system that you want to change. And you ought to present irrefutable arguments supporting your aspiration to change the system. And I don't think these arguments should be moralistic. In other words, you shouldn't tell people something is wrong with the system, it's cruel, it generates inequalities, poverty and crime. No, that's not good enough. Because they'll say, look, every system has produced inequalities and crime. And you're moralizing. You sound like a good Christian. That the system is wrong, it's immoral. It seems to me, we've got to present arguments that are logically irrefutable. And there are a few of them. I mean, Marx tried. Marx has many so-called breakdown theories of capitalism. How will it dissolve itself? Well, immiseration of the working class, that's one of them. The gap between the development of the productive forces and the property relations. Historical materialism, right? There's a clash between those two. Very Hegelian. A clash between the development of the productive forces and the property relations. That will ultimately lead to the demise of capitalism. Maybe too Hegelian, but I'm rejecting it there. What's keeping capitalism afloat? Why is it surviving despite the problems that most of us here perceive and are opposed to? Why? Well, I think I know why. You're at fault. Just kidding. That would be terrible to say that. But I think my answer is, and it's, I hope it's there, right, at the beginning. What is my answer? Human nature, Soviet society as post-capitalist. I think there were five, but I think originally in my original talk there were supposed to be four, then I wrote five. Human nature. Soviet society is post-capitalist. Money is existential necessity. The unavoidability of violence, I mentioned that already, and scarcity. I think those are beliefs. They are convictions, deeply held convictions by many people in the world. And I think as long as they firmly hold on to those notions, that money is existentially necessary, that you cannot have any rational allocation and distribution of resources without money. So when the SBGB talks about a moneyless economy or a moneyless world, they look at you and think, have you lost it? You've lost the plot. Without money, it's impossible.
Right.
I'd like you to remember that almost every textbook in economics in our universities and elsewhere asserts that, yes, money is a necessary and unavoidable feature of economic organization. So that's what you're combating. That's what you're coping with. And then, of course, human nature, a powerful obstacle. The notion, basically Abrahamic in origin, the notion that human beings are naturally flawed. They're flawed because God created them that way. They're basically individualistic, competitive, violent, unruly, unmanageable. All the negatives you can think about. That's how they've been defined in the Christian tradition. And many people believe that. As I was saying to someone earlier, go around, look around, what does Western civilization represent? Go to the major the capitals of the world. Go to Paris and Berlin and Warsaw and London and Washington, D.C. You'll see these cities are dotted with churches. You don't see academies the way you might have seen in ancient Greece. You see churches. And what do people in churches say? Of course they say that human nature is flawed, that something is wrong with us, including our reasoning, that we are bundled up instincts, that we are selfish, not altruistic, uncaring, looking out for ourselves rather than other people, and so on and so forth. So, and I think I'm repeating myself here, I think it's important to understand that that's a powerful obstacle to people changing the world, because they've given up on themselves. That human nature, including themselves, is basically flawed, but not necessarily including themselves, because the people who say that, they mean your nature is flawed. They don't generally mean their nature. They're saying your nature is flawed. And secondly, one of the ways you can come back against that is to say, look, if human nature is flawed, then how about you? Maybe you're a human being, so it means your nature is also flawed, and I think you're a liar when you say that human nature is flawed. I've tried that, almost got into fights. But more importantly, can you get the remember, I think there was that diagram there, the human nature. Can we go back to that? You said it's easy to...
Diagram?
We can go back to where we were before.
The other one.
Yeah, the other one.
Yes.
I've used this often to silence those who claim that human nature is flawed. It's such a powerful obstacle that has to be dealt with. And of course, I took it home. You have a little booklet. The SBGB produced it. I hope you've all read it. About human, are we prisons of our genes, I think it's called. And it's discussed in there. But is that it, human nature?
One of those, you mean?
I think it may be the last one.
No one. Okay,
yeah.
Here we are.
There it is. I found it to be very, very useful. I tell people, I memorize it by calling it BARMS, B-A-R-M-S. Five, B-A-R-M-S. Five conceptions of human nature. And most people are stymied. And they shut up. I said, wait a minute, you're using the term human nature. Have you examined it? Do you know its origin? There's a biblical view, which I've more or less assailed over the last half an hour or so, that human beings are selfish, blah, blah, blah. The pejorative description of human beings, that's the biblical one. And then there's the Aristotelian, which I've also mentioned, right? You heard me on that one. There's a Rousseauan view, with that human beings are born good, but then become bad, so to speak, as a result of being in society. He didn't see the contradiction in saying that. Because after all, human beings did create society. So if they're born good, how did they ever become bad? But then that's the R. Then there's a Marxian view. The human nature is basically a function of the social formation which they find themselves. If they live in a capitalist society, then they'll have a capitalist nature. So it's not human so much as their nature is a reflection of the socioeconomic or the social formation in which they exist. So it's historically fluid. It's not fixed. So you have a point there. That's the M, the Marxian view. And then there's Jean-Paul Sartre. He has a classic statement. It is human nature not to have a nature. I think when you tell people that, when you delineate, if you were to delineate or mention or describe these different conceptions of human nature, you move them slightly away from their fixed notion that, yes, we have a nature. You said, no, we don't have a nature. And this is Sartre's point. We are condemned to freedom. We make choices on the basis of how we reason and how well-informed we are. And we must take responsibility and stop pinning it on nature. Nature didn't make you do a single thing. You passing the buck to say it was nature. No. You made that decision. Don't say nature made you do it. Because it's impossible to ever demonstrate that. You made that choice. Own up. Let me discover. Let me know. How did you reason your way to that action? That's what I'm interested in. I don't know how you reason. How you're reasoning. So that's human nature. It has to be dealt with more thoroughly by the SPGB if the SPGB is really interested in changing the world. And I know you are. Okay, Soviet society as post-capitalist. That, can you go back, if you can get rid of that? You see, if we're going to say that, let me put it differently. The belief that the Soviet experience somehow is a representation of socialism, is a representation, an example of a post-capitalist society, is another ideological obstacle to social transformation. As long as people believe that what happened in 1918 in Russia and collapsed, if you like, in 1991, that 72 years or so of the Soviet experience is a reflection of the future, it's what's going to replace capitalism, then they want no truck with what you're saying. And it's understandable. How does one deal with that? It's very simple. You have to go back to the how Marx defined capitalism. And remember, so as I recall, he was saying it's a system, a mode of production, whose purpose is the production of commodities based on labor power itself as a commodity, as far as I recall. That is the gist of it. He's saying, in fact, in the very first page of Das Kapital, after you move away from the introduction, you'll have one page where he describes it. He focuses on the purpose of production, as opposed to so-called bourgeois economics that focuses on how goods are produced. Marx focused on what is produced. What does capitalism produce? It produces commodities. And within that production, labor power is itself a commodity. And it does this as part of a cycle of accumulation. It does this because the owners of the means of production are trapped within, shall we say, an aspiration to accumulate for the sake of accumulation, to keep on investing and investing to make more and more and grow bigger and bigger. It's a devil take the hindmost race. Those who don't accumulate and grow simply fall by the wayside. And you see it happening throughout the world, in the modern world, right? Corporations becoming bigger and bigger and bigger, and some of them actually disappearing because they couldn't stand the competition, right? So capitalism. But Marx said, don't blame the capitalists. They're trapped in an economic system they don't understand. Let's not moralize and call them evil. It's dangerous. It's evil to call people evil. I told a friend of mine that one day. He said, what about Hitler? I said, you're evil. You were saying something? No, you think you're evil. Okay, so the Soviet Union. Why can't the Soviet Union be presented as an example of a post-capitalist society? One short answer. The Soviet economy had wage labor. The Soviet society was based on workers. People worked for a living. They were paid wages, A. And B, but labor power was a commodity, and it produced commodities, and it had a state machinery that practiced violence. In other words, there was no process of the withering away of the state, and certainly no process of the withering away of wage labor. In that sense, it definitely could not have been called a socialist society or a post-capitalist society. And I'm repeating here, I suppose, what Trotsky said: you can't build socialism in one country. Not only did he say that, of course, that's one reason why Stalin got the ice pick in his head somewhere in Mexico later. But more importantly, Lenin himself said, if we don't have a revolution in Germany, if the Western working class doesn't come to our aid, we'll not survive. And so it didn't survive. Someone called it the Thermidor. That is, the counter-revolutionary forces intervened and distorted the Russian Revolution. But it's not just counter-revolutionary forces. Russia was a semi-feudal society in the early 20th century. It didn't have the economic basis for producing goods in abundance. It could never, ever have produced a socialist society. That has to be understood, because a socialist society obviously requires a high level of development of the productive forces enough to produce goods in abundance so we can end conflicts among human beings. And Russia was certainly not capable of that. The only countries that are capable of that are the advanced industrial societies like the United States and the EU. So the world, Russia was not ready for socialism. Still isn't. Definitely is not. And one of the tragedies, I think, one of the difficulties one faces in talking about socialism is that people will say, it was tried in Russia and look what happened. So it's utopian of you to even think about it, right? Look what happened over there. And then one has to say, no, it was never tried. It never happened. It was never tried. You can't call what happened there any attempt to build socialism. But people in the West who definitely want to besmirch and compromise at some socialism will actually point at that and say, there you have it, it's impossible. It's utopian. It can never work. And so one has to show them very clearly by simply going back to the basic definition of capitalism and saying, no, the Soviet Union, USSR, was never, ever socialist and can never have been. Okay. What have I left out? Resources are scarce, and so you can't ever have a society or an economic system producing goods in abundance because resources are naturally scarce. Simple answer, I use it often, seems to work. I would say resources are not, they become. Nuclear power was not a resource in the Middle Ages. Human ingenuity produces resources. You can't say resources are scarce. You can say resources are insufficient at this given point in time, given demand, but you can't say that resources are scarce. Because you don't know what can become a resource. You don't know. It's impossible. You can't make that prediction. I'm rushing here because I like to stop and have you ask me questions and make some contributions. Scarcity. So, in fact, it's right there. I'd like to get to something more. That's it. I've been told that you had some people from the TZM, the Zeitgeist Movement. Okay. And I'm in touch with them in L.A. I do meet with them and discuss, because I think they have a point. I think there are some similarities between you and them, between us and them, so to speak. I'm saying I'm part of you also. We have discussions. I know they're opposed to the notion of class, and they're very technicist or technological. They think that what we should be saying is that we can organize the world economy on a more rational and scientific basis, and that's what we should be arguing rather than talking about class struggle. I go along with that to some extent, and I think I was telling someone this morning that I'm not happy with this emphasis on class. And if you ask me, if you'd like me to talk about that, I will talk about it. But more importantly, there was a Zeitgeist movement. And then there are people who argue that capitalism, and so I'm doubling back here, what's right with capitalism? Because when we approach people, we try to point out that something is wrong with it. What about those who say something is right with it? And what's right about capitalism? No. What's right about it is that it's the most rational form of economic organization. Resources are scarce, so we need money. And we need a free market. And once we have the latter, we will rationally allocate resources and we can eradicate poverty and crime and all the other ails that you complain about. So nothing is wrong with capitalism. It just has to be better managed. And the way to make sure it's better managed is to make sure there's a free market, that governments never intervene to corrupt market forces. Do you agree with this? You don't? Okay, well, why not? Well, I'd like to give some reasons why you shouldn't agree, and I wrote them out last night. Off the top of my head, and it's at this point I'd like to double back on something I said earlier about the separation of the social sciences from philosophy. People use the word free very freely. They use it too freely. The free market. When is the market free? Was it ever free? I mean, governments intervened from the beginning to set up the conditions for a market to exist with different kinds of laws, for example. So government set the tone. Government set the context for the operations of the market. When, therefore, is the market free? Do you mean government should never intervene? And which government are we talking about? At what level? You mean local governments? National governments? The United Nations? Which governments don't you want intervening in the market? Don't you want governments to intervene and settle disputes among different competitors? Don't you want governments to construct laws that protect private property? You do. So why are you saying that there's a conflict between the market and government? There is none. Governments help to create the market. Now, you may say governments intervene too much or too little. That we can debate. But you can't just counterpoise governments and the market. Can't do that. Historically, you can't, because governments have actually helped with the creation of the market, and without governments there'd be total anarchy. So you can't say that governments should never intervene or become involved with the market. Do you mean, and this is what happens often when people try to defend the free market and oppose the government and the market, what they will say is, what I'm talking about is big government intervening. And you say, well, how big? Well, I mean, you have no objection to big government with respect to the Pentagon or the Defense Department, right? It's totally government, right? But you object to government intervening in the market, and you have no objection to governments controlling the defense industry? Why? So I think it's important to show these proponents of the free market that they are, shall we say, how do I put this? They are ill-informed and logically illiterate, and I should never say that, but that their arguments are not based on the full analysis of the conditions that they want to defend. So the market is never really free. They want a free market in the end because I can see a connection between what they argue and their beliefs about human nature. The free market, the idea of the free market, to my mind, is metaphysics. It's very similar to the notion of God. In fact, that's what they're saying. Look, let's get away, let's leave it to the market. The market is God. Hard to define, but we know it operates. So that's why I call it's a metaphysics. Markets do nothing. Human beings act. So they're really passing the buck when they say the market will generate stability and rationality and justice. It's passing the buck. It's not the market. Human beings make decisions. So I think it's important to bring that home over and over again. Look, it's not the market. It's not nature. It's us. It's how we think and how we act on the basis of how we think. So I don't think we should ever allow people in discussions and debates to bring in these abstract notions, to bring in notions like the market and God and entities that they can't properly define, and say that those entities are responsible for the way the world works. It's not government. Let's call it spade a spade. It's David Cameron and people in the cabinet. They're making certain decisions. So let's stop using words like government and point to policies and decisions that people are making. Okay, I've been talking too much and too long. I'd like you to talk. What have I left out here? I'm looking at this. I've left out lots of things. I've left this out. What's wrong with capitalism? Well, wrong is the wrong word, because I don't want to moralize. Look, we agree. It causes a lot of pain, no doubt about that, throughout the world. Absolutely. The system, I mean. The actions of people, of investors. No doubt about that, right? But there's something else I'd like to emphasize. I think I found this most effective in talking to people about capitalism, why it should disappear. And to emphasize this, we've got to go back to philosophers, and especially to a particular philosopher named Immanuel Kant, who argued that human beings are trapped in space and time, and that's one of the reasons we invented God. But we are trapped in space and time. All of our perceptions are grounded in space. That's why we are so much afraid of death. We can't imagine our own non-existence. If you try to think of yourself as dead, it's impossible, because you've got to be alive to think about it. You cannot imagine your death. And I think that's why we are so afraid of it. It's unimaginable, unthinkable. Okay. What has that to do with economics? Well, it has this. Human beings they're constrained by time. They're forced to think in terms of time. They always have to say beginning and end. And that's why Kant argued that the notion of God creating the world is nonsense. That's why he was agnostic, so to speak, because he said, you can't ever say when the universe began. Yet your mind is trapped within the notion of beginning and end. All minds are. Notions of beginning and end and notions of space. So time and space are part of the human cognitive makeup. And this brings us closer to the issue. Capitalism produces commodities based on wage labor. You get your wages and salaries, that is, your access to the means of life, on a weekly or a monthly basis, or a quarterly basis if you're an investor. So it's not just the working class that's suffering. It's the capitalist class also. They're also worried about the future. Money doesn't make you happy, everyone agrees, although Zaza Gabor said it's not true. If you think money doesn't make you happy, it's because you don't know where to go shopping. But more importantly, we're trapped in space and time, and in time especially, we live in the future. Human beings are not just interested in a daily or weekly or monthly access to the means of life. They want a kind of assurance that there are no threats, no obstacles to the gratification of their needs now and forevermore. Capitalism cannot give you that. It does not. It keeps workers and investors trapped within short-term gratifications of their needs. And that's the basically, to my mind, that is what's wrong with it. That's why it cannot survive. That's why we have these struggles, because human beings are looking for what I call PBS, permanent biological self-realization. If you invite a homeless person into your home and offer them a large roasted chicken and a bottle of your finest wine, go ahead and say, you know what, I've got to nip across to the store. I'll be back in a couple of minutes. You come back and your TV is gone, your car is gone, and you're shot. Damn it, I just fed that son of a gun. No, you didn't. You didn't give that person an assurance that tomorrow they'll get another chicken and a bottle of wine, and next week and next year to them their lives. And they've got kids too. And they begin to think about their kids' future, you see. And so capitalism, despite the abundance, despite the incredible capacity to produce goods many times more than is necessary to gratify the 7.5 billion people, the needs of the 7.5 billion people in the world, there is still massive, massive hunger and malnutrition and poverty throughout the world. And it's not just hunger and malnutrition throughout the world. There are people in different parts of London, I'm sure, who worried about where they're going to sleep tonight and where they're going to eat tomorrow morning. But there are also certain people in Mayfair and Belgravia and so on and so forth who worried about the price of caviar. But they're worried, definitely. And they've all got psychiatrists and therapists and so on and so forth. So I'm suggesting to you here that it's important to point out to those people who we think are at the top that you know they're in trouble too. It's the system. Something is wrong with it. It doesn't gratify the purpose of human social formation. We got together as a species to better gratify our pursuit for food and shelter and clothing. And some people say sex, but I disagree with that. But the point is, we got together to better gratify those needs. And it's not working. Despite the capacity for the capabilities of abundance, we're still in limbo. We're still struggling the way our forefathers struggled, who left in the morning and went out in hunter-gathering societies, hoping they would make a kill somewhere and bring the food back, but worried about next week and next year. We haven't moved an inch. I'll stop there. Please go ahead. Ask questions.
Okay, thank you, Yehudi.